Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and so many people these days get blood tests, and they have no idea what the results mean. Sometimes they'll see a high or a low indication by a certain value. So today we're going to talk to someone who's written a great book on how you can interpret your blood test and how you can make it reveal more about your health in a proactive way. So our guest is James LaValle. James has been a frequent guest on the previous incarnation of the show, which used to be called Health Talk. He's written several great books, and his books include Cracking the Metabolic Code, Smart Medicine for Healthier Living. He is a registered pharmacist. He's also certified clinical nutritionist. He's nationally recognized. And he is also founder of the LaValle Metabolic Institute. And he's got extensive experience, of course, in media as a spokesperson. He's designed products, and he's a prolific guy. So without further ado, welcome to Intelligent Medicine, James. It's nice having you back on.
It's great to be on, and it's great to be on in the new incarnation.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So the book, Your Blood Never Lies, the subtitle is How to Read a Blood Test for a Longer, Healthier Life. So this is a great idea. I got to say, I wish I'd thought of this. Because what a great
That's
angle.
Very good of you to say that.
No, it's very true. Because this is such an important question. You know, people read blood tests, and it's such an unsatisfying experience sometimes to get a blood test, because you go to the doctor's office and, you know, maybe the doctor will send you a copy of the test ahead of time. I just went through this with a relative. This relative showed me a blood test, and she said, I see all these highs and lows here. Then when we went to the doctor said, it doesn't mean anything. I have no idea what these tests mean. It's disconcerting to me that some of these values are high and low. But he actually gave me no information. He said, you're fine. You're fine. Don't worry about it. Nothing to see here. Just move along. So your book takes a different approach, because I think you're looking at it from the standpoint of not just are you sick unto death, do you have a serious health problem, but also from the standpoint of optimization. Isn't that correct?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, look, when your numbers go out of bounds, every doctor in America knows when numbers go out of the normal range and you now have a disease, that everybody's been trained how to read that. One of the big issues that I found over the last, 30 years of, being in clinical practice and teaching in clinical settings with physicians and pharmacists and academic venues too, is that nobody paid attention to the trends that are going on in people's labs that are telling them, here is where your future health is going. And that, I mean, if we're going to get to the bottom of healthcare and really try to, get proactive, it's more than about preventative checkups. It's about alarming people and identifying what's going on when the numbers start to shift. And then even more importantly, honestly, I think you nailed it with your relative. People get their lab test and they just get a call from the nurse and it just says, all your labs are normal. And that's all you're told. And you're not told, are they high normal, are they low normal, are they optimal? I mean, where am I? And that's why, that really, I mean, to be honest with you, this book took a while to write. And at times I was almost disgusted with writing it because it took a lot of time and patience to go,
I could see that. I mean, it took an enormous amount of effort, because you looked at just about every single major blood test. And not only that, but you came up with all the possible interpretations, which must have been really difficult for a high this, low that. And then, in addition, you came up with really tangible suggestions. What can you do? And that's a very big job.
Yeah, it was. But you know what? I have to tell you, it's been real rewarding, and I'm grateful when people say, hey, boy, great book, and, gee, I wish I'd have thought of this one, right? I mean, like what you had said. I mean, it's right. I got a big smile on my face right now, because you know, the one thing I know is that nobody really wants to become diabetic. Nobody wants to have a heart attack. I mean, if you go down and you pull the street, right, Dr. Hoffman, you go around and you ask people, hey, do you want to have a heart attack? I'm betting most people are going to say no.
Well, absolutely.
Right. So that was the whole purpose of the book, is let's start getting this out as a tool for doctors, because I think it'll help doctors, as well as consumers, begin to come together about the communication of health and prevention as it relates to one of the most basic things that doctors do, and that's take blood and get a lab test.
Well, let's take, for example, and I actually saw a segment on Dr. Oz that kind of illustrates this. I don't watch that program all the time, but I happened to be flipping through the channels and I saw this. It was a perfect illustration, I think, of what we're talking about. Thyroid blood tests. And he did, you know, like he does usually, like an audience participation thing. And he went in the audience and he sat down he stood in the aisle next to two women, and he said, exchange your shoes. And the first question he asked is, do you both have normal size feet? And they said, yes. And said, now exchange your shoes and try on each other's shoes. And one had a size 9 and one had a size 5, and they had a heck of a time, you know, with each other's shoes. They didn't fit. So the notion was that they both have normal, shoe sizes, but we tend to, you know, we don't treat shoes the way we treat thyroid blood tests. We say normal, and it's a very wide range. But we really should be a little more accustomed in the way that we address thyroid problems than saying, look, if you're 0.5 to 5, you're fine.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that the biggest thing we find now is that, and I'd even say that if one of the biggest issues I found when I started doing this, you know, working on this book is that, you know, I go in and I look at the research, and a lot of the research and even what is expected in clinical practice hasn't distilled down to the lab values yet and the everyday doctor's practice. So, for example, thyroid's perfect. Even the American Society for Endocrinology says 2.5 thyroid stimulating hormone. Anything above that means you should be starting to consider treatment. Well, most people still go by that, you know, 4.5 thing. And so there's individuality to our labs. I mean, there is a certain amount of individuality to, you know, in flex and breath to what is normal and how we feel. I think one of the biggest things that we haven't respected is just that example. When TSH gets to 2.5, thyroid stimulating hormone, I mean, like I said, the Society for Endocrinology says there should be treatment. Where most people are walking around still with 4 and 4.5 TSHs. They've got dry skin, they're sluggish, they're a little puffy, you know, they're not thinking quite as good as they should, they're depressed maybe, their glucose has gone up a little, you know, right? They've gained fat, you know, all the things that you see with low thyroid, they just don't feel energy. And yet, because they haven't crossed the threshold of 4.5, everybody's still going, we'll wait till you go over 4.5. Then right. We're going to treat you.
Exactly. I mean, so I think what I've analogized it a little bit, too, is, you know, when you go fishing, you catch a fish under a certain size and you throw it back in the water. And so I feel that doctors act a little bit like fishermen. You know, when patients come to the office, they say, well, this isn't very interesting. You know, you're maybe auditioning for a disease, but you don't quite have it yet. So little fishy, you go back in the ocean and grow a little bit and you'll come back one day and you'll be over the limit and then I can haul you in. I'm taking a cynical view towards this because I'm a doctor and, you know, and this is a little bit the way doctors think.
Well, you know, I think, once again, I think, you know, you look at, you know, new ideas don't get accepted, old people die is the term, is the phrase I always love from Niels Bohr, right? It's that, you know, if we think that medicine and health is stagnant, you know, I got to tell you, in my pharmacy school where I got trained, we had all sorts of natural products that were in the, you know, the display case from the 1800s and 1900s that are very similar to the natural products that are not just the popular healthcare market, but the physician healthcare market, right? And so, you know, we kind of get a little myopic and don't understand that, you know, these other options and approaches of looking at our body and trying to be preventative have been around a while. They resurface, they go away. And we have to challenge them all the time because, let's face it, I mean, I know when I talk to docs, and I teach a fair amount of docs through a couple organizations, and, you know, they're challenged all the time. I can't sleep. I have no energy. You know, I'm 30 pounds overweight. I just need a pill. We all know now when somebody says, I just need a pill, there is no pill. If the pill was invented to make you healthy, everybody would be walking around healthy. You know, there's no magic. It's hard work, understanding your chemistry, understanding what you need to do. And I'll tell you, one of the big ones was glucose. You know, when Kaiser Permanente did this study on 46,000 people over a decade, and all the people that had normal glucoses. So nobody walked in. They were the fishermen, and all the fish got thrown back in the water.
Right.
Right?
In that analogy,
everybody's
yep.
normal, mm-hmm. 65 right. to 99. But they categorized it every 4 or 5 points. So it went from, you know, 84, then 85 to 89, you know, 90 to 94, 95 to 99. And what they determined after 10 years, 46,000 people, for every point over 84, it represented a 6% risk of becoming diabetic.
Hmm. Right.
And think about that. How many people walk into, you know, typical doctor's office and have a 93 glucose?
Which is, quote, normal.
Right. It's a 48% risk. So basically a coin flip. If you're going to be a diabetic in the next decade, and that means you're going to have possible kidney problems, or you're going to go blind, or you're going to have peripheral vascular disease, you're going to have cardiovascular disease, you're going to have fatty liver, right? There's all those great comorbidities that go with diabetes. But yet nobody is saying at 93, hey, you need to change. Here is your risk. The trend in your blood is saying this is where you're going to be. And that, you know, one of the things I've been passionate about for a long time, because a lot of this information has been published from very big studies, from the kind of the hallmark institutions of our society, and yet we're not listening to them. And that was kind of one of the things that kind of struck me odd, because I was worried about having enough clinical evidence for what I was talking about. You know, because you always worry about that. At least I do when I'm writing a book. I don't want to be too sensational. I want to have facts that kind of give the evidence. And that was one of the big ones for me. It's, you know, we're not even doing a good job on informing people that they're going to be diabetic in the next decade, much less what their lipid profile shows. Right?
Well, yeah. Speaking of which, you know, you talk about triglycerides. You know, first of all, I'll ask you to define triglycerides. But in your section on triglycerides, you list the norms. And I noticed that normal is a triglyceride that is anything under 150. So somebody who checks in with a triglyceride of 149, they're told that they're perfectly healthy. Do you think that's acceptable?
No. Actually, in my opinion, they need to have a triglyceride ever under 100 mm-hmm. In order for it to be optimal.
Correct.
And so there's, once again, the 150 is what has been defined as the acceptable range. But if you want to have an optimal triglyceride reading, your reading should be under 100. Now, American College of Cardiology is finally coming around to that, and the next guidelines, they're going to drop the triglyceride optimum reading from 150 to 100.
Nice.
So that's great.
Yeah, they're finally listening.
Yeah, exactly. So it just goes to show you that once the evidence gets so big, like triglycerides should be at under 100, you know, medicine will listen. But it's a slow process. As long as you've been involved in medicine, you've seen it, right? I mean, how things
sure.
finally end up getting accepted as either a problem or, you know, something that you really, you know, needs to change for quicker treatment. And so anyway, yeah, that's one of the great examples that under 100 triglyceride being really important. And of course, a triglyceride is really it's a type of compound that gets made in your body. When you're taking in too much sugar and you're very insulin resistant, meaning your body's pumping a lot of insulin out, you start to store these basically sugar, but a good way to term them would be sugar fats, because they're real damaging fats. And you're literally, your liver will fill up with them, right? And you can start to become very engorged with these triglycerides and really start to stimulate this whole fatty liver process. And so when people are producing all these triglycerides, they don't realize that they are making their blood stickier, their endothelium, so the inner lining of their arteries starts to get less competent. they start to create chronic inflammation in their body. And so what I always tried to get across in the introduction to this book is you don't get sick overnight. Most people develop diabetes for 20 years. They develop heart disease for 30 years. They develop cancer for 10 or 15 years or 20 years, right?
Yep.
And it's understanding, looking at my readings, where they are, how am I going to change the direction? How do I steer that rudder so that I'm going true north towards health and reducing my risk? There's no guarantees, but how do I reduce my risk?
Well, you know, you talked earlier about conditions that may affect the liver, prediabetes, insulin resistance, so-called fatty liver, where the, you know, good term, sugar fats, the sugar gets rapidly converted into triglycerides, which get deposited in your liver, and then your liver ends up looking like a yellowish fatty blob instead of a normal healthy brown color. But are there blood tests that indicate whether you're moving in that direction towards liver toxicity or liver, what's called non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, the condition of fatty liver?
Sure. And I think that's just foie gras when it turns yellow.
Exactly. That's in nature, or not nature, it's an unnatural thing. They stuff these geese with food to make them get fatty liver so that they have a heavier livers that are more valuable in the marketplace.
Exactly. So there's various things that you can look at. Obviously, if you are looking at, there's something called AST and ALT, which are liver enzyme readings. So as people have their liver get more congested, their liver enzyme levels start to go up. So they have more enzymes working harder in order to try to make the liver function. And so as that enzyme rate is going up, it's a sign and an indicator that there could be a problem. And a lot of people don't screen for, they don't regularly, and the other thing is that if you're on any kind of medication, if you combine the fact that there's a lot of medications that cause your liver enzymes to go up with a diet that's really poor, you're begging the liver to become fatty. And the thing about the fatty liver that I think is so important, and I hope for the listeners out there, they understand this. You know, when we hear the term liver transplant, I mean, most people would, it's safe to say they would cringe a little bit. You know, they think transplant, and that's as complex of a medical event, at least in my eyes, it's one of the most complex things you could do is transplant an organ into the body and then manage it after it's in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And more people are going to require a liver transplant due to fatty liver in the next 10 years than due to hepatitis C.
Wow.
Because people think, well, I'm hepatitis C. I'm clean. I don't have to worry about that. I've never been exposed. Fatty liver. But more people, and this is a lifestyle.
So is that what you're saying in a way is that you're at greater risk of losing your liver than if you're a rock star, you know, shooting IV drugs, developing hepatitis like, Crosby, yeah. Who had a liver transplant, all these celebrities who drank themselves into liver transplants. But you can eat yourself into a liver transplant more easily than these dissolute rock stars.
That's exactly it. Now, obviously, it's a population game, right? Because you don't have millions of rock stars. We have millions of people with metabolic syndrome, and you want to think about this in terms of why it's so important to pre-screen and look for your liver enzymes, look at your cholesterol, look at your triglycerides, look at the size of your lipid particles. Why you want to look at all this stuff is you don't necessarily feel when that fatty liver process is starting to take place. So you don't know that the liver enzymes are starting to go up, that you're making too many triglycerides. How many times have you seen people walk into your office with a 250 triglyceride perfectly walking around and didn't have a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is we have 47 million people right now estimated with MET-S, 67% of the population overweight, 33% are obese, and 22% of the obese population is estimated to have a fatty liver.
Wow. That's scary stuff.
It's sobering, right? I mean, it really is.
So throughout the book, you know, you talk about various supplements that may play a role in normalizing some of these abnormal states that are revealed by blood tests. And permeating the book, are references to what seems to be one of your favorite supplements, which is chiolic aged garlic extract. Tell us a little bit about that.
I will, and I'll first say that, you know, I am not a stockholder in chiolic aged garlic extract, nor do I get paid by the bottle. So I'm saying this totally on the fact that I have looked at all the research, I've reported on it, I've written on it. This is a phenomenal natural compound that's been studied in over 700 different either studies or publications. Dr. Budoff, UCLA Medical School, interventional cardiologist, kind of leading the way with some of these studies, but there's a lot of interesting studies. Why I like aged garlic extract, there's a couple things. One, when Dr. Budoff was doing CT scans to look at coronary calcification, he found that when people took aged garlic extract versus placebo, and the placebo was a statin and aspirin, right? So it was aged garlic plus statin and aspirin versus statin and aspirin.
Well, yeah, that's not really.
These were people.
Good placebo. That's like we're talking pretty active drugs. You know, statin and aspirin.
I think that's where you're going with this.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. See, because you can't. If people have pre-existing coronary artery disease, which is what this study was about,
right.
People that already had plaquing.
It was unethical not to get statin. Right. It was unethical
right.
to
so,
deny them
so
the statins.
Here's the bottom line.
Yeah.
The placebo, the statins, and the aspirin plaqued at a rate of almost 23% the following year. 23% greater plaque.
Right.
Chiolic, when added to it, only created 7%.
Whoa.
Now, here's the thing I gotta be honest with you, so I'm gonna be a little cynical, because I'm a clinical pharmacist, taught in pharmacy schools for 20 years, right? I mean, why aren't we recommending aged garlic extract when UCLA School of Medicine's cardiology department, one of the most respected cardiology departments in our nation, says you're gonna get 3 times the lowering of calcification rate when you add the aged garlic to it? So, that's an impressive study. The next thing that Budoff found when he was looking at these CTs is he could look at bone density and he could look at fatty liver. And what he found is when people were on aged garlic extract was that their bone mineral density loss ceased. And that means, and there's a, of course, to tell the people listening out there, when you're losing bone mineral density, it's directly correlated to you plaquing your arteries.
Okay, so interesting. So it's like it's a zero-sum game in a way. It's like it comes from some place and goes to another, or it's a misdirection of calcium.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And so what he found, in addition to these effects on the plaque, was that the bone mineral density stabilized, and so that you weren't losing bone. And the third thing that they found in this, you know, that the trial was, they looked at these studies, was that fatty liver was reversed.
Whoa.
Reversed.
Wow.
So when you look at a big population of people that either have glucose problems and are insulin resistant, and their lipid profile means they're making really small, dense LDL particles that penetrate into your vessels, and you're making a lot of triglycerides, and you're not making enough HDLs, and you have a lot of oxidized LDL, meaning that the lipids that you're making, the cholesterol you make, your body is rusting them. So it's oxidizing them, just like I call it the rate of rusting on your lipids. Aged garlic extract, or chiolic, works against all of those. And the last thing it does that makes it really interesting is that it improves vessel pliability, because even in a human trial of people that had resistant hypertension treated with meds, when they were given chiolic versus placebo, a 10-point drop in systolic blood pressure. You know, that's pretty astounding on people with resistant hypertension that are already being treated. So,
you're making me feel good, James, because I don't miss an opportunity when I see a patient who I've evaluated with, say, an EBT heart scan who has plaque, or a patient who's had a bypass or a heart attack, to put them on chiolic aged garlic extract, because I really think it's one of the important things, along with, of course, you know, fish oil and things like curcumin
magnesium.
And resveratrol and magnesium. You know, these are among the things that you recommend in your book for people who have higher cardiovascular risk.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, the interesting thing that's happening now, of course, is the fact that, you know, we're at this crossroads. I know we're, Just got appointed as a assistant director, and Dr. Heyman, my partner in our consulting practice, is the director at George Washington University's Metabolic and Integrative Medicine program. It just started. Mm,
that's great.
And so we know 270-hour program, right? Mm. So it's interesting that there's a real movement, serious movement now, I believe, in medicine to say, okay, it's time to start to look at these things and listen to the results that people are getting. And that's great. That's what we need.
Well, that's certainly exciting, because I know you and I have been toiling at this field for many, many years. And it must be gratifying to see finally some of our ideas getting mainstreamed and accepted and taught to not just pharmacology students like you've been doing for years, but also to med students.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So in your section on cholesterol, you know, you talk about the numbers, and you know, a lot of people point of pride, my cholesterol is super low, but you take a little bit of a contrarian view of that, so share that with us.
Well, I do. So I think that cholesterol can be too low, and I understand when conventional medicine is looking at taking targets that are well below 70, and diabetics, in fact, LDL is as low as 55. The issues I have with it is that when we really drive total cholesterol down, especially you know, when you're driving LDLs down so low, that you lose hormone production and you lose cell membrane health. And so it's well known when men take statins, their testosterone goes down. Well, when their testosterone goes down, their cardiovascular risk goes up in a different risk bucket. So, you know, so it's a catch-22. Oh, great, we got your lipids down, but now your testosterone's low, and you don't feel good, and your bones are wasting, and you don't have any energy, and, oh, wait a second, that's a risk factor for developing insulin resistance. So it's one of those things where I don't like to see us over-medicating to bring that number down. The other piece is that it's not just about the number, it's about the quality of the cholesterol you make. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always give the analogy of, you know, so everybody hears about LDL cholesterol being bad. And
right.
And so new tests have come out, right? One was the VAP test, which mm-hmm. is, kind of an estimate of particle size.
Right. So it's like a slicing and dicing further of the LDL. In other words, it's not just LDL, but it breaks down the LDL into the okay LDL and the very bad LDL. I guess that's one way of explaining that.
Right, that's exactly right. And then they got more precise. After the VAP, they said, we're going to do an NMR lipoprofile where it gets very exact on measuring what's called your, not just your particle size, how big or little your LDL are, but your particle number in the sample. And so the more little LDLs you have in the sample, the more your risk. And if you talk, like I talked to the former head of cardiology at Cedars Sinai, and he was all over this data, and he's like, look, I can tell you one thing for sure. When you have a bunch of small LDL particles in your body, you're making a lot of small LDLs, you're most likely going to be plaquing and have your highest risk for heart disease. And of course, we know there's other causes, high cortisol, you know, it could be insulin, it could be environmental burden, like
how
lead.
How do you change that? How do you change that? Or is that just like your dumb luck, you know, it's genetics, you know, end of story, that's your fate?
It's a good question. And just to kind of help the viewing audience understand, if a tennis net was your inner lining of your artery, and you had to throw two size balls through that tennis net, if I try to throw a beach ball through a tennis net, it doesn't go through. If I try to throw a BB through a tennis net, it goes through. Mm-hmm. The BB that goes through is small LDL cholesterol, and it deposits between the inner lining of your artery, and then it attacks. And that's why it's important to modify this. And to your question, yes, you can change particle size and number, first of all, by diet intervention, adopting a low glycemic load diet, modified lower carbohydrate diet, but not, you know, not to the Atkins-esque extreme low carbohydrate diet, But a modified low carb diet, get out of the refined sugars, you know, probably get off of dairy. There's probably a few other interventions I talk about. The first thing is you can change your diet. The second thing is you can exercise moderately and you can change your lipid profile. The next thing is you have to have adequate vitamin D, so get your vitamin D checked. Mm-hmm. And then the next piece to this is you can look at different strategies. So you can think of niacin is being a modifier of your LDL particle size. So we've seen it over and over again, although it's still argued about and bannered about in the clinical literature. We've seen niacin do that. Aged garlic extract does work on changing your particle size, and so that is a value. Bergamot extract changes particle size, so that's a value. And, of course, we always have to think about things like beneficial flora in the gut, remodeling cholesterol and having an effect on cholesterol production. So the secondary things that kind of come out from that are taking care of all the different networks in your body that contribute to why you're making small, dense LDLs, which typically relates to insulin resistance and low thyroid and elevated stress hormones. Those are the key things that drive that. So, but there's direct things you can do to change it. Niacin, aged garlic extract is fantastic. Chiolic. As I said, bergamot, those are some great strategies, and get that vitamin D tested.
What about oxidized LDL? You talked about oxidation of, that you damage the LDL particle, and that can make it even worse. That's a different consideration than the particle size, right?
It sure is. So oxidized is how damaged the LDL you have is displaying. And there's a fairly new marker that's just coming into the U.S. that's a oxidized LDL marker that they've been using in Europe.
We use it. I'm proud to say we've been using that test for, 3, 4, 5 years. There's a lab in Brooklyn called Scheel Labs that we've been using quite successfully for a few years. And it's really an accurate predictor of who's at risk.
Right. Exactly. That's the great thing about it. And I think you're going to see an explosion with that test. I mean, because we're really starting to find out that, ox LDL is where it's at. And once that LDL gets damaged, man, you're going to get the immune system attacking it. And so there's things that can be beneficial there. Remember all the controversy over vitamin E, is vitamin E good for your heart or not? Turns out that when you take a full spectrum vitamin E, so it has gamma tocotrienol, the alpha tocopherols, it's got gamma tocopherols, all those different spectrums of vitamin E tend to reduce oxidized LDL. And in fact, tocotrienols, in fact, act, if you think of, the local police and then you think of the state police, tocotrienols are the state police of your LDL particle. They travel the whole state and they scavenge oxidation and protect the LDL molecule from being oxidized. Now, there's other things that could be of value. I mean, aged garlic in studies showed an 80% reduction in oxidized LDL. That's a big number. And once again, I know chiolic permeated through the book in a few areas, especially as it related to liver glucose and lipids, and it's for good reason. There's lots of clinical data behind it. The other ones that you consider would be the great plant antioxidants.
Right.
So things like grapeseed and resveratrol.
Pycnogenol.
Pycnogenol. Pomegranate, especially in women, pomegranate. Mm-hmm. Fantastic data on that, right? So it's very, once again, it's all about creating a strategy. But the problem is people don't go and get the test, look at their numbers, and say, where am I and what do I need to do about it?
So I'm looking at your book, and there's all this basic stuff, BUN and CBC, and that stuff, and I think that's great because a lot of people don't understand their basic blood tests. But I immediately flip to the back of your book where you get into these more specialized optional tests. Those are fun. What tell us about some of the additional tests that doctors might not ordinarily order for you, but might shed a lot of light on your health status?
Yeah, well, things like cortisol are really important. People don't realize how important, getting your cortisol tested is. Looking at hormones, those are another area that when you're looking at labs for disease versus looking at labs for health, you might think of even having different lab values and different labs that you're looking for. So if I'm trying to optimize my health, I might be looking at, hey, I want to look at all my hormones. for example, sex hormones, secondary sex hormones, I may want a more comprehensive thyroid profile than just a screening for thyroid illness. Is my thyroid operating functionally at its peak? Do I have enough free thyroid hormone in my bloodstream? Because there's lifestyle things I can do to change that. So thyroid hormone's a perfect example. When you get under stress, first of all, if you don't have enough chromium, selenium, tyrosine, iron, for starters, you're probably not going to make enough, and iodine, you're probably not going to make enough thyroid hormone. But if you are making enough thyroid hormone, it has to convert to a more active thyroid hormone. So T4 is what your thyroid gland makes, and T3 is what your body has to convert the T4 into in order to get benefit.
Not normally measured. Not normally measured, because we measure in conventional medicine the T4 and the TSH, but we're not looking at the really business end of the thyroid hormone, which is the T3, the one that really activates your metabolism.
That's exactly right. And so when your T3 is low, your neurotransmitters don't fire in your brain as well. Your insulin receptors don't work. You don't burn fat as well. I mean, you don't absorb nutrients as well. And guess what? You don't make as much hydrochloric acid. And so that means I'm going to need to take the little purple pill. And it might be because I'm not making enough thyroid hormone. So there's a lot of issues that are there that are around it. So the point being is, if you're insulin resistant or you're making a lot of cortisol, in particular, if you're making a lot of cortisol, and cortisol comes when your body's under perceived stress. And, it's the old story of, once you look at a white tiger enough, you may not feel the alarm like you did the first time the white tiger came chasing after you, but the alarm's still going on. And so cortisol is the stress hormone your body releases, and when you release more cortisol than you should, it turns down your thyroid hormone. And means that you don't make as much of the active thyroid hormone T3. And so, once again, these are these specialized tests that can give you just a little bit more insight into where am I going? How am I feeling? What's my outcome if these things are going to be elevated or depressed?
You talk about homocysteine in your section on optional tests. And many doctors these days poo-poo homocysteine. I'm hearing more and more from patients when they ask their doctor to perform homocysteine, their doctors say, oh, that's been debunked. Nobody does that anymore because that turns out not to have anything to do with anything.
Well, what's funny about that is that because they don't feel it has a direct effect on cardiovascular disease, it got all of a sudden, it's debunked, but it still has relevance with kidney disease, and it still has relevance with Alzheimer's. And it's still a sign, even if it's not a direct marker of a disease, when your homocysteine is high, it means you're not doing a process in your body called methylation correctly. And methylation is what makes your body detoxify. It's what makes your body make neurotransmitters and hormones that your body needs in order to function. And so when you see an elevated homocysteine, it's almost like a red flag that there's some errors in this person's chemistry that's going to keep them from functioning at their optimal state, even if it had no value on a disease claim. Right? Even if it didn't do that, which I still believe it is valid, but if it didn't do that, it's still a guidepost for us to see about an important part of our body called methylation. In fact, arguably one of the most important cellular functions we do is methylation. And so, so that's the key thing about homocysteine.
When doctors perform routine blood tests, they generally don't check for nutrient levels, but you make the case that it's important. Well, maybe not for every nutrient under the sun, because, we could test for, 30 or 40 or 50 different things. That would be, impossibly expensive. But there are a few key nutrients that you talk about, in your book, Your Blood Never Lies, which you think really are worthwhile and make a difference. What are those?
Yeah, I think one of the big ones that you really have to look at is magnesium. And even though there's no ideal blood lab test for magnesium, you hear about a serum magnesium and people, my magnesium is normal. In the clinical literature, it says once magnesium gets to midline or low normal in serum, it generally represents a significant intracellular loss, meaning that your tissues have lost a ton of magnesium. Now, why am I on the soapbox about magnesium? Well, probably because it's the most depleted mineral in the U.S. population because people aren't eating the foods that are contained in magnesium. And secondly, magnesium is involved in everything from blood pressure to mood to, most importantly, it is the number one nutrient deficiency associated with the development of diabetes and metabolic syndrome. And these are government studies where they tracked thousands of Americans. And they said, you know what? Our conclusion is magnesium's the problem. So, you know, and I know we're not thinking about putting magnesium in the water, Bob, or thinking about putting some other things in the water, a.k.a. statins. But, right. You know.
Maybe antidepressants will be next.
Oh, yeah, we got to have that. And why not put a PPI in there while we're at it? So the point being is that magnesium status just isn't looked at. And a lot of people suffer from, I've got leg cramps, I've got muscle spasms, my legs are tight, I can't walk that long anymore. Why am I feeling anxious? How come I can't sleep? You know, where'd my blood pressure problems start to come from? Why is my blood glucose going up? You know, why can't I perform when I exercise? You know, it's funny, your blood magnesium level goes up as high as tenfold when you exercise.
Wow.
It's supposed to.
Yeah. But if there's no magnesium in your tank, you're not going to be able to ignite your fuel to have optimal performance.
That's exactly right. That's exactly it. So magnesium's a biggie. You know, I think CoQ10's a biggie. Zinc status is a biggie. I mean, you know, zinc status is so important because
for people who get sick all the time, for example, you know, we gotta make right.
Exactly. So, you know, once again, it's starting to understand there's some base things that you can grab and you can begin to understand the value of, well, do I need to change my diet? Do I need to take a supplement? You know, I find it hard for people to eat enough things that have magnesium in it. So I'm, you know, like you, recommending it all the time.
All right. So our call to action is get this book. I really recommend it. It's excellent. And like I say, James, I'm envious because you picked a great topic. Your blood never lies. How to read a blood test for a longer, healthier life. And you got a website as well. What's the website?
It's Metabolic Code with two C's. So Metabolic Code, all one word, .com.
Okay. And there you can find more information about the book and your other activities.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. And there's an additional call to action for our listeners, because we talked a lot about kyolic aged garlic extract. And if you want to find out more about it, go to their website, kyolic.com, K-Y-O-L-I-C. And I've got a number that you can call for a free sample of kyolic. James, isn't that one of your favorite four-letter words, F-R-E-E?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I love free.
Okay, so here's the number. Right, jot it down, folks. It's 1-800-421-2998. 1-800-421-2998. And since you're listening to a podcast, you can stop the tape and you can rewind and you can hear that number again. And you can thereby get a free sample of Kyolic. Try it. It's great. And it's just, incidentally, short explanation, James. Why can't people just eat a little more garlic? You know, I love garlic. I put garlic in a lot of I put it in my salad dressing when I make homemade salad dressing, and I cook with garlic. Same deal, right? Is aged garlic extract or not?
No, that's a great question. No, it's not the same deal. Eating garlic is great, and there are some health benefits to eating garlic. But aged garlic extract, they basically grow organic garlic, and then they ferment the garlic. And when it's fermenting, much like when you take grains and make beer or take cabbage and make sauerkraut, it changes the properties of the garlic extract and creates a whole new family of natural compounds that are inflammatory fighting, cholesterol specific, antioxidants, right? A whole family of new compounds get born out of that fermentation process. Now, the other thing that's important is when you eat garlic, everybody knows it. So you're kind of sending a signal to everybody, hey, I had garlic, right? Because, you know, you get that garlic odor on your breath. It can go through your pores even. When you take aged garlic, it does not cause any type of odor to occur either in your breath or through your body odor, because when you age it, it takes the compounds out that are volatile and were the source of that problem. So that's what's neat about it. You get all the benefit of garlic, and I'd say none of the risk.
So you can't lose. For a free odor-free sample, call 800-421-2998. And James, I want to thank you very much, and congratulations on your book, Your Blood Never Lies. Thanks for joining us here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via a convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.